I don't want to rule or conquer anyone. I should like to help everyone if possible. Jew, Gentile, black man, white. We all want to help one another. Human beings are like that. We want to live by each other.
When one is able to repeatedly step into the purity and hardened space of genuine and heightened awareness, miracles manifest. Conscious evolution becomes inevitable, and the revelations to one's spirit becomes revolutionary within the simplicity of its own essence. Awakening then becomes of its aware the destination of such a path when one has answered to the calling, unfolds to reveal the ripening of one's universal truths. The book of positive light, remembrance of the heart.
And so welcome back to another segment of Quantum Mindfulness Radio, as the intentions of each broadcast here will be geared in guiding you to other realms of potentiality and possibilities. And I'm your host, Jovo Ayala Ayapana, a registered nurse, veteran, and the author of my new book, The Book of Positive Light, Remembrance of the Heart. Quantum Mindfulness Radio broadcasts every other Monday, 8 p.m. Pacific, 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, only on the BBS Radio Network. Now, the topic of main focus for tonight's show will be based upon the search for transformational models of change, but from a different and more reliable source based upon the systems theory of approach. And so I have with me on Quantum Mindfulness Radio to assist along with this search is one of the so-called rude boys of what I would like to call one of the more realists of this revolution in heightening consciousness. And he is my dear friend and intriguing special guest on Quantum Mindfulness Radio, M.A. Carano, as we will be conversing about the unknown world of spiral dynamics. Now, spiral dynamics, in short, argues that human nature is not fixed. Humans are able, then, you know, for the most part, when forced by life conditions, to adapt to their environments by constructing new, more complex conceptual models of the world that not only can allow them to handling the olden, but perhaps even the newer converging problems that we are facing together as a species. And according to what M.A. Carano has observed and termed when viewing humanity in his own eyes as one single organism. Yes, spiral dynamics, an approach that can prove to being beneficial for all of mankind. Now, M.A. Carano is the next inspiring soul to enter upon the alchemy and sacred nature of the space, a quantum think tank of sorts tonight, as we will be further conversing about quantum mechanics and the physics of this consciousness, spiral dynamics. Now, M.A. Carano is an experimental philosopher and systems consultant living and working out of Yale, New Haven, Connecticut, as the senior intelligence analyst and vice president of Avatar Paradigms, a consulting agency whose main mission and focus is to bringing about the message of holism, synergy, and conscious evolution into the homes, universities, and corporate boardrooms throughout the United States. As a former United States congressional candidate as well, and the author of his book, Asleep in the Helix, Survival and the Science of Self-Realization. Currently, Carano resides as the sitting chair of philosophy for the Libertarian Party of Connecticut, as well as acting representative of the Global Association of Systems Thinkers. So welcome to the show, dear listeners, as I present to you M.A. Carano to Quantum Mindfulness Radio. Thank you, dear friend, for joining me here tonight.
Oh, thank you. I'm so excited about this. Thank you.
Now, Carano, from our most recent conversation, you had made mention of many topics that had intrigued me, from the many philosophers, the many quantum theorists, sacred geometry, the suppression of consciousness, the awakening of consciousness, the
right.
Nature of humanity, the true essence of the ego, hidden truths, and essentially even truth for that matter, from within itself. Can you be able to tell our listeners how your specific path of enlightenment, per se, had come to be?
Yeah, you know, it's not necessarily all that dynamic or all that abstract. What happened is that it started off between the period of about 13 years old up until the point I was about 21. And at this time, in most people's biographies, they were really just enjoying their youth. But that was a really tumultuous period for me, specifically because between the ages of 13 to about 21, 11 friends and family members who were really near and dear to my heart died, either by tragic accidents or by sickness and disease. So my adolescence was normally spent contemplating life and death situations and the grand significance of who we are and where we're going in the sublime view of all things. So as a result, I became really interested in existential questions. And my life had a turnaround when my brother recommended a text to me, which was written by the master theologian. His name is Houston Smith. It was called The World's Religions. And it was the first time in my life that I penetrated the radical cynicism and the pessimism of what was my mindset at the time. And it was almost like the clouds just for that moment just parted and provided me with a clear vista of what was possible for the human spirit. And since that moment, I had embarked on a quest to discover what was the meaning of life. What was the meaning of self-realization? Is it possible? Is enlightenment possible? So I was around 20 years old at that time. And by the time I got to around 28, 29 years old, I had found some substantial answers. And I thought that they were worthy of being shared. My self-concept overhauled to not just simply being a seeker of truth, but I became, in essence, even though my education was from the Pierre College of Art, I became, in essence, a philosopher, and I became damn good at it, too. So I began debating other academics, other professionals in the field, establishing a reputation for myself, and I began synthesizing the knowledge that would become the foundation of my work in a text called The Sleeping Helix, Survival and the Science of Self-Realization. And with the completion of that, I went out and moved to St. George, Utah for a period of, about a year, where I really concretized and crystallized my personhood and established my deepest, truest sense of self and my highest potential. And that's since has become the mutual core of all the different layers of potentiality and personality on top of myself that I act from. So that's pretty much who I am in a nutshell at the level of the ego.
Now, from our previous conversation before the broadcasting of this show, you had made mention just most recently, from the very journey at the end of this particular part of that chapter, that you had reached a level of enlightenment in what you had referred to as the Sabbakawa Samadhi. How did you go about even reaching this level of practice?
Okay, it's actually pretty interesting. What happened is that it was just around the period of time to which I was tying up the loose ends for a Sleeping Helix, Survival and the Science of Self-Realization. And there's a cemetery which I frequent 2-3 times a week, and it's where my high school sweetheart, you know, she was the one I mentioned. She died in a DUI when I was 18 years old. So the place has become a church for me, and it's become sort of like a mystic, sort of ancestral homeland. And I reconciled and I individuated the experience, and I overcame the experience. I'm now at peace with the experience by constantly immersing myself in this environment through spirituality, through exposure. And when I was meditating in 2008, I had a brief insight into the possibilities of human spirituality that made me overhaul, reamend, and reinterpolate the text of A Sleep in the Helix to take on a more decidedly spiritual approach and spiritual slant. But nothing stuck at that particular moment. But in 2012, it was 2013, while I was again in another state of meditation, I obtained something which people call Sabbakalpa Samadhi. Sabbakalpa Samadhi is transitory enlightenment. I had the full-blown Satori and enlightenment experience, and in that moment, that's when I actually conceived entirely of the complete and unified metanoetic approach. Before that, it was just parcels and snapshots and engrams of insight. That's all that it was. But in that state of consciousness, I realized that I could effectively map out the enlightened state of consciousness and make it apparent for other people to at least think through systematically in a rigorous way, and they could at least emulate it if they can't obtain it.
Now you had mentioned just in that that conversation in itself, that material that you had mentioned just the last couple seconds about metanoetics. And we'll be getting into that a little bit later in the show. But within this experience within itself, of the Sabbakawi Samadhi experience, what did you actually realize from this self-realization process?
Well, Sabbakawi Samadhi, it's a transitory state of enlightenment. It opened up during the course of the next 12 months following that into a much more depth, a much more in detail, much more immersive experience, which sages and seers throughout Eastern and Western traditions have called Nirvikalpa Samadhi, which they would call final realization, final enlightenment, moksha, liberation. And it's the fruit of spiritual practice, which, again, Hindus and Vedic philosophers would call sadhana. It's the Buddha state of nature and the Buddha state of consciousness. It's the awakened Christ heart. It's the Krishna consciousness. It's essentially opening up and realizing radically your own I am-ness. And one of the things that really struck me about the experience was specifically how much can be communicated about the experience effectively and how many misperceptions are trafficking through, I'd say, the New Age community. And also how many misperceptions are tracking through the alternative health community and just general philosophy. Like, for example, there's a lot of people who say you have to live in the moment. No, you don't have to live in the moment. There is no moment. The moment as opposed to what other moment? A lot of people say you have to live in the present. Well, what present? The present itself is only the interface between the future and the past. What present? Future and the past, if they don't exist, if those are the illusions, and then the present is simply that moment which is defined as being betwixt these two things, well, what present are you talking about? So there's a lot of misperceptions that orbit it. Instead, what people have to do is learn how to restructure their vernacular and to speak about it using a totally different set of memes. And fortunately, because we're 2,000 years after the fact, there's a wide variety of ideas, concepts, and vocabulary terms, and even systems approaches that we can now use to speak about the enlightenment experience in a much more copacetic, conducive, and efficient way. There's a lot that can be communicated about it. And I really don't think that people need to struggle too hard to realize that. I've searched for it for 15 years. It took me 15 years to find that. And once I made that connection, I realized, wow, it's ludicrous. Like, I spent 15 years searching for something which was literally nothing other than the texture of concrete underneath my skin when I'm walking across the patio on a hot day, which is nothing other than the feel of the breeze that's just embracing me during the course of an autumn spring afternoon, or an autumn afternoon, not spring. But that's really the essential concept of it. You have this radical awareness which opens up, and you're just not even participating in it. You're just simply granting it being. That's it.
And yes, you had made mention of many buzzwords there that just resonates with what experience I am going through personally. And for the people who are enlightened or who are about to get enlightened or so awakened, per se, they often want to be so much part of this experience. And so now for the main topic of discussion, Carano, can you be able to describe in much deeper detail as to what spiral dynamics is all about and how it relates and integrates with the philosophy and science and spirituality of what you are about to do here in theory within this conversation?
Well, first, let's go ahead. Let's provide a constructive criticism of what spiral dynamics is not, because a lot of people seem to mistake spiral dynamics for a path or a model of self-actualization as if it narrows down to an omega point. It's not. It's true that self-actualization entails the process of rising ever higher into the different layers of consciousness and cognition and higher and more sophisticated ways of conceiving the world conceptually. That is true that self-actualization furthers it, but there's nothing in the model of spiral dynamics in and of itself that entails enlightenment. There's nothing in it that entails self-actualization. All of this is just a spectrum that is stratified into different layers of being that are unified simultaneously, like the rungs of a corkscrew that widen and broaden as it ascends upwards into different layers of complexity. And each layer of complexity transcends and includes the layers beneath it as different, almost analogous to the way we would imagine rings in a tree. They're called V-meme stacks, and each cognitive species is called a V-meme. Now, spiral dynamics was first conceived of by the psychologist Dr. Claire Graves, and he conceived of it during the mid-50s when he was attempting to map out the varieties of cognitive experience, and he gave questionnaires to his
students, which he was a professor at a time at a university, and he noticed that their answers fell in a pattern and that when he did a follow-up survey, they seemed to progress in a pattern. So he mapped this pattern out, and eventually that became the biopsychosocial systems approach to human cognition. Yes, he did call it the biopsychosocial systems approach. It really was called that for a time. Now, he had two affiliates, and they were two accolades of his. One was Dr. Don Beck, and another was Christopher Cowan. They were protégés, so to speak. And they continued to carry the flag of Claire Graves in their own research as they developed his biopsychosocial systems approach into what we now readily and most identify as spiral dynamics. Now, spiral dynamics is, again, a model of human cognitive complexity in terms of how people grapple with problems of value, change, and setting and organizing priorities. So it doesn't entail necessarily that someone who's at a higher level of cognitive complexity in the spiral of things is going to be any more intelligent than somebody at a lower level. All it means is that their thinking about problems is going to be more complex, and they're going to consider a wider variety of details. And not every level of complexity is even desirable. For example, you don't want to use a jackhammer to drive in a nail into a 2x4. No matter how much more complex a jackhammer is.
Right.
So exactly. So different layers of cognitive complexity apply and are suitable for different life conditions, and you don't want to get them confused. If a problem is simple and you need a simple answer, use that simple answer. Don't overcomplicate it. Use the appropriate memes to address that problem. A meme is a unit of cultural transmission. The term became integral with the spiral dynamics movement because it was first produced by Richard Dawkins as a kind of unit of cultural transmission that behaved kind of like a virus, and they synthesized and formed into systems in an organic fashion. And Beck and Cowan realized that what we were looking at wasn't meme systems, they were V-memes. They were paradigms for organizing memes that were built into the cognitive repertoire at a biogenetic level that found actualization through catalysts in the environment. That's spiral dynamics in a nutshell, but spiral dynamics basically tends to fascinate and to intrigue others because of its colorful nature of the model and because of its beautiful geometries which are associated with it. And that's something that we could probably get into right now, because I think that in order to present a model of consciousness, people need to at least have a rudimentary understanding of what these different layers are. Can we do that?
Oh, absolutely. Please do.
Okay. So everybody begins life at the most basic level of cognitive complexity, and there's a color which is associated, which is neutral, and it's called beige. And the beige level of cognitive complexity is active in newborn infants. It's also active in people who are suffering from debilitating conditions in the Asperger spectrum. And beige is otherwise known as survival sense. It's instinctive, its intelligence is genetic, it's neuromuscularly reactive. It's almost analogous to something as if you were a Freudian id, which is being compelled by libidinal energies from deep within yourself. But it's a Freudian id that doesn't have the benefit of having a fully concretized, crystallized ego. So beige doesn't have a distinct sense of self. Its primary drives and its prime method of motivating itself is through, again, libidinal instincts that might roughly correspond with Freudian psychoanalysis of the Eros and the Thanatos, which are drives of the id, but that's not to say that Freudian psychoanalysis is part of the model of spiral dynamics. It's not. Those are just means that seem to explain some of the activity at this level. Beige thinkers, they tend to forage for food in asocial survival bands. They tend to mate opportunistically. Let's put it this way. If life conditions ever exceed the cognitive complexity of beige, it usually reacts viscerally, but if it realizes that it can't overcome them with its processes of thinking, it's going to do one of two things. It's going to simply curl into a ball, it's going to lay down, and it's just going to die. Or it's going to evolve to the next level of cognitive complexity. So when life conditions outpace its level of cognitive complexity, it's do or die. And it's at that particular moment that beige makes a transition out of beige, and it begins to acquire and synthesize some of the memes that it's absorbed that far. So beige fades into purple. Now, purple is otherwise known as kin spirits. It's sort of a tribal V-meme system. It's a clannish V-meme system. And purple thinkers, they strive to live in harmony with nature's seasonal cycles. It is one which is preoccupied with the concept of submitting to the edicts and decrees of omens and of signs. It places a heavy emphasis on the authority of elders and ancestors. Purple thinking is highly magical. It believes that it receives messages from guardian spirits, and Someone who thinks in purple isn't necessarily tribal, but people who are traditionally of a tribal mindset usually tend to be purple. Now, we find purple really in 21st century first world civilization and culture, and cultures that are here from other cultures, and they might believe in guardian angels and the intervening influences of ancestors that watch over them. Purple thinking tends to, like I said, to deify ancestors. It reveres elders. It really believes in protecting ancestral grounds and in sacred spaces. And for the purple point of view, it's the world is really one. It's infused with a wide variety of enchanted spirits and of gods and goddesses. We find that the purple V-meme is active in a lot of Disney's fantasy and magical and mystery-themed cartoons for children. Children usually tend to be purple thinkers at about the ages of about 2 to about 6 or 5. That's purple thinking. Red might flare up at the terrible twos, but traditionally their primary mode of cognition is at the purple level of kin spirits. Now, when purple begins to no longer be at the level of complexity as a mindset, which is sufficient for negotiating the terms of its existence, that's when it begins to make a transition into red. Red is, again, it's not a cool color, because cool colors in the spiral of things indicate cooperative mindsets, harmonic mindsets, self-sacrificial mindsets. They tend to be altruistic, empathetic, and intuitive. Red tends to basically be elitist. It's individualistic, it's egoic, it's assertive, it's strives traditionally to be dominant in its own sphere. And we find that the first elitist V-meme emerges out of purple as red in what we call power gods as a way to command, to control, to consolidate red, purple. So purple tends to basically organize like a clan around powerful red personalities, which become the nucleus of that. And red thinkers, they're egocentric. And for them, the world is divided between victors and victims. And given the alternative, they much prefer to be a victor than a victim. And that means in many different instances, they have to go ahead and victimize people in order to be a victor. Now, it's important to realize that at each level in the spiral of complexity, they have their own distinct senses of right and wrong. So if you look and you classify another level of thinking about problems of value as evil, it's usually an indication that it's evil only in terms of how you think about priorities and problems of value from your own ring of development in the spiral of development. So a lot of people tend to stereotype red as sociopathic or as psychopathic or as antisocial. It's not, because given the life conditions, there are certain circumstances that red thinking is wholly appropriate. If you're in prison, you're either red or you're dead. Because if you don't have the ability to activate red thinking within yourself, you're going to get your ass kicked, or you're going to get shanked. If you're a Rwandan warlord, you better be red, because otherwise you're not going to be able to survive those life conditions. So red thinking strives to be bold. It acts decisively. It loves to inspire fear and awe in others. It strives to avoid shame. And red thinking does what it wants, when it wants, however it wants. And it shows no mercy. It feels no remorse. And when confronted, it fights to the bitter end. Red fundamentally believes that it's better to be feared than it is to be respected, or better to be feared and respected than it is to be loved and liked. So given the alternative, it's going to prefer to be feared and respected by you. And red acts in such a way that it believes that there's no point worrying about consequences that aren't going to come. So seize the day, carpe diem, baby. Let's take his initiative now. So that's a wholly appropriate way of dealing with problems at a particular level when those life conditions arise. But when it ceases to work, life conditions tend to evolve into something which is called truth force, which is the blue meme, which is, again, is a self-sacrificial meme. Now, truth force is really focused on meaning and finding purpose in life and self-sacrifice in service of an absolute, all-powerful, transcendent truth. Blue thinking, it believes that patience and long-suffering are virtues which are ideal for realizing and achieving rewards, which usually tend to be deferred. And it strives to enforce laws and to impose order on all things. And it uses the force of truth in order to do that. It strives to restrain the impulsiveness and the excesses of egocentrism, because it arises when red simply no longer works for the world. There's a proliferation of red that's really corrupting and distorting a wide variety of human systems. Truth force, in terms of blue thinking, emerges to make a reformation of that. And it sees the world as basically as a hierarchical structure with a higher power at the top of it, whether it be God, whether it be the state, whether it be the, you know, transcendent consciousness, or whether it be cosmic mindfulness, anything. It tends to organize things from on top, from the top down, in a pyramid of command and control structures. But when blue thinking becomes too rigid, it becomes too constricted in its own crystallization of things, again, it breaks out again into another elitist V-meme structure, which is an orange color of cognitive complexity, and it's called the Strive Drive. And the orange level of cognitive complexity, it's like red, but only softened a little bit by blue influences, and it learns to route around the rules of blue and sometimes to just simply work within the framework of blue thinking in order to manipulate blue thinkers. Orange thinking, it strives for independence. It's got an entrepreneurial spirit. It loves personal liberty. It believes that the existence of individual rights makes selfishness principled and ethical. We find that mindset in a lot of the Tea Party initiatives that are sort of surfacing now. It's also part and parcel of Ayn Rand's philosophy. Orange thinking tends to believe that there's a value to working hard, and it strives to innovate and strategize to achieve prosperity and material abundance and affluence. Orange thinking strives to seek out the best solutions using reason and science. So it's a rational, it's a scientific beaming structure. And it uses science and technology to enhance the standard of life that it enjoys. It believes that quality of living is determined by standard of living. And that's really where the primary emphasis of it plays into. It also enjoys competition. It plays for keeps. It's usually seen in CEOs, in sales associates, in supermodels, and in the fashion world. That's orange thinking. And again, its knowledge system is based on reason and evidence. But when orange thinking, again, becomes too greedy and it becomes detrimental to the environment, or it begins to be disruptive, or it's simply not sufficiently complex to be able to adapt to the world's life conditions, it moves up to the next level in the complexity of the spiral of life, which is the human bond element of the green V-meme.
And Corano, with less than 2 minutes remaining before the end of the first segment of the show, mm-hmm. We will transition into the next color scheme of this of this model, of this blueprint,
right,
in consciousness. Dear friend Corano, can you please list for our listeners your contact information before we transition to the next segment?
Absolutely.
Your website as well, and how we can
right.
be able to purchase your book, Sleep in the Helix: Survival and the Science of Self-Realization.
Absolutely. Visit www.avatarparadigms.com. All of my contact information is listed right there, including links to Asleep in the Helix.
And so when we return after our station identification break, we will continue with our conversation with M.A. Corano, author of his book, Asleep in the Helix: Survival and the Science of Self-Realization, on Quantum Mindfulness Radio.
Information and knowledge, bringing humanity closer to truth.
Conversation of the orange V-meme into the conversation about the green V-meme, which is really a relativistic way of perceiving problems and operating in terms of conflict resolution. It's also called human bond. And the green V-meme strives to differentiate itself from orange because it seeks to connect with others in the spirit of empathy, of mutual communication. It strives to also reconcile conflicts by speaking at the heart level. It also believes that communities are ideally reformed and organized based on understandings of peace, of equality, and of mutual understanding from one another, with an epicenter rooted in a deep appreciation of one another's mutual humanity. It believes that nobody in society as sophisticated as ours should ever have to go without, and society's riches are traditionally better shared if rather than just simply consolidated into the hands of a privileged few. Green thinking prefers to liberate hearts and minds from the prisons of greed, of superstition, and dogma, and wherever it makes decisions, it seeks a consensus with making those decisions to not only ensure that other people are included, but also to be rational as well. So it strives to begin to incorporate feeling and reasoning together. And again, it strives for mutual respect and equal opportunity for everybody. Now, green thinking represents the highest level of cognitive complexity for what's called first-tier structures. But when we cross over into second-tier structures, there's an enormous leap of complexity in sophistication that emerges with what's called the flex flow yellow V-beam structure. And again, yellow is a form of elitist V-beam. It's warm, but it's different from red and orange before it because it's autonomous and it doesn't strive to achieve at the expense of others. It's what happens when green thinking graduates to a level of cognitive complexity that more fully and more fully appreciates the nature and the importance of individualism. Green thinking or yellow thinking, it's almost like having a left brain with the ability to feel, but it doesn't allow the feelings to interfere with it. It embraces nature's ebbs and flows with flexibility and grace. It puts a premium on functionality, on adaptability, on knowledgeability, and on versatility as the primary virtues which are most effective for living. And yellow thinkers, they're systemic, they're integrative, they seek a harmonic balance between conflicting truths and uncertainties. It likes paradoxes and paradox resolution. And it realizes that individualism and that freedom and self-interest are important so long as they're pursued without harm to others and certainly without jeopardizing the environment. Yellow thinking is different because it appreciates the multiple dimensions of living in the world through studying through experience. And yellow thinking is the first time that a thinker is actually able to activate and to go into subordinate levels of cognitive complexity that's already graduated through the spiral of human thinking. So a yellow thinker can move into a red environment and act like red and talk like red. A red thinker can move into a green environment and it could flow with that level of vibration. It can do each and every one of these things up to its own level of complexity. But when even the flex flow V-meme ceases to be adaptive, again, it goes from a level of thinking in terms of integrated systems to realizing that even integrated systems aren't enough in terms of our ability to apprehend and appreciate the world, and it graduates to the turquoise V-meme. And from this perspective, it needs the cooperation of others to gain access to the information flows. It needs to work in a team environment, and that's where turquoise thinking really begins to flare. Turquoise thinking is also called the global view, specifically because it's the first V-meme structure to really look at the whole and try to put everything in context with where it stands with regard to a greater worldview. And turquoise thinking is individuated and it's differentiated from yellow thinking because it really emphasizes right brain cognition, despite the fact having lots of data. It strives to synthesize healthy collectives from individuals that are forged into resilient emergent communities that really are healthy and whole. And they emphasize that wholes are more than the sum of their parts. Now, turquoise thinking is preoccupied with the understanding that nature synergies possess an emergent intelligence that really isn't requiring of human input, and they strive to think globally, but they act locally because they understand the importance of the chaos effect and how individual differences at small levels have the ability to amplify over time to create radically powerful results. Turquoise thinking puts a deeper emphasis on health and happiness, and they see it as deriving from the ability of individuals to artfully synthesize and integrate their wants and needs into global systems that dynamically serve the self, but also the world at large as an equal extension of itself. For turquoise thinking, they see the self as a kind of dynamic, evolving cell that is structured and founded into a larger organic whole that is itself a cell. And this pattern continues to replicate upwards in sort of fractal radiances that move up into emergent levels of complexity. And really, turquoise thinking also tends to basically see global networking and whole spiral communications as routine for itself. And it's really a 21st century adaptation to the life conditions that we're currently living in. But when turquoise thinking begins to become obsolete and it's no longer able to solve the problems that it's confronted with, where does the spiral dynamical model say that we should head? Because up until this point, there was really nothing higher than it. And we're really being confronted with a new species of trouble. Kai Erickson used the term to describe it as that. And so from this point forward, we now have to discover a new way of cognition and a new way of thinking if we're ever going to satisfy some of the terms and conditions of the survival requirements. And as you know, Joe, I mentioned before, and everybody should know again, I'm an experimental philosopher foremost, but my work is in systems consulting. And in 2007, I learned about spiral dynamics, and I diagnosed myself as yellow because of my understanding of systems, and I also had an elitist sense of self that was really based on knowledge and an expansive resume of skill sets. And I also had an insistence on personal autonomy and behavioral versatility. Again, that's why I diagnosed myself as yellow. But when I was learning about turquoise as a new V-meme that was even more complex and higher than my own cognitive type, I became cognitively insulted by the sense of elitism that I was lacking. And that sent me on a quest in search of the turquoise beam, to learn as much about it as I possibly can so that I could ultimately graduate into it. So I read Michael Talbot's Holographic Universe, Kevin Kelly's Out of Control, Daniel Quint Ishmael, Ken Wilber's The Spectrum of Consciousness, Urban Laszlo's The Science in the Akashic Field. Basically, I sought out and swallowed every turquoise meme, not every meme, but every turquoise meme that I could possibly muster or acquire so I could go ahead and I could muster up the resources with myself to graduate into that level. And by year two of doing this, I made a smooth, clean transition into turquoise. But by year four, I began developing the sort of know-it-all, you know, smug-ass sense of self-centered elitism that defined me when I was younger as an adolescent, when I was red. And that other people, I believe, they didn't really know what they were doing or how they should be going ahead and fixing problems, and that really I should be running the show, goddammit. And that's how I saw it. So there was this elitism that was manifesting in me, systems complexity. And I didn't really quite identify it particularly yet just then. So I began engineering a managerial technique, which I based off of general systems using Buckminster Fuller's Synergetics, Norbert Wiener's The Science of Cybernetics, and I even included Eastern notions of karma so that I could use this to hijack social systems and consolidate the resource flows of limit cycles within these systems at the leverage points under my control. And I wanted to use these leverage points so that I can use the stocks and flows and manipulate them to my advantage to further my own self-actualization. And I called the system Karma Technics at the time because, like I said, it meshed Norbert Wiener's cybernetics with Indian Lee and motifs of karma. But once I finished this system, interviewing business owners to see if their current way of thinking was anywhere near as being in line with my own model of things, which was really a trans-holistic, four-dimensional logic that incorporated things which I would call transfinite, holistic, reductionistic, and incompleteness methods into its paradigm. So when I was doing these interviews, I asked people two questions. I said, what is it that makes the world go round? And what is your definition of a mature human being? And after doing this enough, I came to the conclusion that talking to small business owners was really a waste of my time because their thinking was largely linear, it was reductionistic, and it overlooked the value of integrated systems that synergize at multiple levels.
Exactly.
Right. So I only began to make progress when I was calling and questioning larger business owners and major stockholders. And what I learned was that their thinking was more in line with how Darth Vader might propose to run a company than, say, like Margaret Wheatley, who is a classic turquoise thinker. So they weren't like turquoise Yodas. They were more like red Sith Lords when it came to knowing how their systems worked and how sloppy, chaotic swarms flowed and how to force these flows into obedience with cunning, with planning, and with big-picture thinking. And beyond that, they wanted totally integrated systems for corralling these flows, and they wanted to control all the leverage points within these systems so they could synergize the currents where they needed them to be synergized. And they had the ability to cause chaos and disruption in the limit cycles where they thought that their outputs weren't exhibiting the kind of goal-oriented trajectory that they wanted them to. And they did this for the purposes of realizing higher incarnations of the potentials within themselves and also within the gaps of their own business's wholeness. But they didn't want control for particularly malevolent purposes, so to speak. The goal was largely the same, but they weren't really interested in money or political pull. Rather, they had all those things already. Or at one point they had them and they lost them, and they really just didn't care to get them back because they didn't believe that they'd satisfy them. What they wanted in terms of the control was that they wanted to realize the potential of their businesses, which for them included the satisfaction of seeing themselves push their people to realizing their own potentials. So they tended to realize that these levels of self-actualization couldn't be achieved unless the stocks and flows of their systems were directed towards some sort of omega point in the system that they determined in advance using a vision of things, because others were generally too busy either paying attention to the whole of the system that was right in front of their faces than to the possibilities that were inherent in the system as kind of an incompleteness to it. So holism wasn't the theme they were using. It was something beyond and more than holism. In other words, incompleteness theorem was a concept that seemed to basically guide their decision-making. The incompleteness theorem that was essential to their system was the potential that of what the system could be. Their system was whole as it stood, but it was incomplete in where it could go. So the first thing that I thought about this was that it was a lot like Red when I was doing these interviews, but it was at a totally new level. But a major difference existed here because where Red thinking hijacked planes, this new model of consciousness, this new model of cognition, it hijacked entire airliners. in ways that were swift.
Right. So really, yeah, really, you're essentially saying right. that you know that there's a definitive transition here from the corporate way of thinking of leading countries and governments through connoisseur type of mindset and going towards right. More or less the creator type of mentality, like authors, painters, well, and so forth like that.
Kind
right?
of like that. Look at it like this. Look at it like this. Look at turquoise thinking as like purple thinking, only up a hectic of complexity. And knowing systems thinking with everything it's learned through the under tiers. But also look at this coral thinking as mirroring red thinking beneath itself, but with that level of systems complexity that red itself formerly lacked when it graduated through those levels. So that's what we're looking at. We're looking at a new species of red. And these coral thinkers, they walked into organizations, they caused chaos where it needed to be caused. They let everyone know that they were the ones who were wrecking things to establish the obedience that they needed to establish through respect and to establish respect through fear of uncertainty. And then they strained this chaos and the synergies that they hijacked, and they spurred the organization's natural abilities to function like dissipative systems by introducing principles and policies that prompted them to self-organize into conformance with a morphogenetic field of a vision that they had set up in advance. And that's how they were doing it. And that's when I realized I was looking at coral. So then I started looking for places where coral was also in operation at more evident levels of our experience. And it occurred to me that G20 summits that are populated by Bilderberg groups, trilateral commissions, and the Council of Foreign Relation types, they were totally in line with this type of thinking. And these are politicians, they're captains of industry who hijack entire systems, they crash them where they needed to be crashed, they create and sow and orchestrate chaos, and then they stream the chaos into a larger transcontinental synergy for the purposes of creating kind of like a global empire, which is consolidated around and beneath themselves. In terms of what we're told and conditioned to, a lot of our conditioning is coming from the turquoise band, or not the turquoise, the coral band that we're dealing with that's really at the epicenter of all this, because we're dealing with a level of complexity, all right, that terrifies turquoise into conformity. It grinds yellow thinkers down into servitude, and it exploits first-tier structures like resources to be culled for the actualization of its own potentials. And it usually prefers to manipulate naive green into catapulting its own propaganda, which they feed to green in order to win and manufacture the consensus of first-tier swarm structures, because they realize they can't control their systems and they can't realize their ambitions without the momentum of the first tier welling behind them. So a lot of the new age ideas that are floating around were actually invented and orchestrated by coral thinkers specifically to get them behind their propaganda.
Okay.
Wow. Right. Wow.
the aha moment.
Right. The idea, like, for example, feminism is one of their ideas.
Right.
You can look this up in terms of the interview with, I believe it was Aaron Russo, with Nick Rockefeller. Feminism was an idea that coral thinkers, or at least coral think tanks, produced for the purposes of going ahead and orchestrating society around an agenda at a point of leverage that they can manipulate and control. Believe it or not, much of the green thinking in terms of peace, love, multiculturalism, diversity, all this has a value, and the value is built into it specifically because they want the relevance of it to overshadow the detriment of the ideas so that people focus only on the positive and they don't realize the long-term implications of using these systems to control them.
Right.
So we're looking at a level of complexity that's cunning, that's manipulative, and it has far, far greater degrees of insight into the power of its own ideas than anything that turquoise could come up with. So it instantiates this type of propaganda at the level of the first tier because it needs the first tier to kind of function as the catalyst, as agents of change, so it can command and control these things. And, you know, I've already begun doing what I can to make the transition from within myself from turquoise into coral. And I've done this by synthesizing memes that I can use to seize control over my environment in subtle and pervasive ways that would really destroy the possibilities for my own life, where I just to sort of just blithely conform with my life conditions rather than defy and to seize control and even conquer and dominate my life conditions. So I've been working with Dr. Donald Peck, who again is an acolyte and a protege of Claire Graves, one of the founders of Spiral Dynamics, other than Beck and Cowan. And he's confirmed, Michael, you found the coral V-meme. And he's preoccupied right now with personal issues that he really hasn't had the opportunity to go ahead and work with me for probably about 6 months, but we found it. And
That is pretty much the revelation that you wanted to uphold for the second half of this show, or literally with this broadcast within itself, is this this founding of this V-meme that you have found from not only from the enlightenment that you have discovered from meditation, but from your research.
Right. More so my research, not so much my meditation, but more so my research. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Now, I've gone ahead as a cursory title. I suggested to Don Beck that we call Coral Thinking Chaos Avatars, not after my business, but as an homage to the fact that Red is called Power Gods. So if you go from power up to chaos and you go from gods to avatars, then you can see that there's that sort of symmetry between them. And in terms of my own business, I try to instantiate and use coral concepts for doing consulting purposes for doing consulting sessions with other people. And I've prepared a statement that I'd like to share with you about coral thinking. Would you mind if I read it?
Sure. Yeah, definitely, for sure.
Okay. So it goes like this. If people wanted a complete synopsis of it, it would be this. Spawned in the cutthroat life conditions of virtuous synergy, slowly corrupting into vicious cycles to ensnare and destroy all who would comply, chaos avatars emerge within the planetary holism to perceive an essential absence that was formerly overlooked by virtually all other minds but itself. An incompleteness theorem containing the possibility of new frontiers that, in order to be survived, one must first evolve to master in advance with uncompromising dominance. Fractally iterated at all scales in self-similar domains of competitive and cooperative life conditions, these conditions consolidate the form of a reality whose metaphysical ultimatum is universal to life itself. Control, adapt, migrate, or die. By seizing control over the trajectory of its own evolution, chaos avatars arise to defy and dominate the global villager's world of delicately balanced, artfully synthesized systems that would seek to constrain its excesses. Endowed with a metamorphic multiplicity of personas, the strange attractor of the chaos avatar's sense of life, which gradually appears over time, is one requiring a protean bravado that takes no prisoners, makes no promises, and survives as a consolidating eye of a psychosocial vortex of mindsets that swiftly triangulates upon the leverage points of its life conditions, which chaos avatars both guiltlessly and intuitively exploit to orchestrate the flow of all currents within towards a fuller realization of its own highest human potentials. Yet in light of the disintegrating chaos of the global villagers beautifully harmonized egalitarian nexus of life systems, the chaos avatar's value structure is one wherein the authoritarian command and control initiatives it imposes on the spiral of human life are once again perceived as not only reasonable, but wholly justified. Furthermore, given the intuitive efficiency by which chaos avatars cognize the action potentials for crisis and opportunity that loom inveterate to every situation, then it should come as no surprise that such a new breed of thinking would exhibit anything less than dynamic, colorful, and altogether masterful displays of systemic dominance over all major currents of influence within its environment, albeit psychological, biological, sociological, technological, and even spiritual. High above in its perch, situated at the top of the humanist hierarchy of needs, the view is clear where chaos avatars perceive and prepare for multiple futures simultaneously by consciously evolving to such futures in advance. So it's not merely adapt to them, but to also dominate them when they finally manifest through their mastery of the cybernetic principles by which such rapidly changing life systems are found to thrive and die by. Chaos avatars discover that by first hijacking the leverage points of the system, and then by strategically promoting synergy and chaos where needed, it's able to go ahead and seize full tactical advantage and to positively reinforce those limit cycles that maximize the life conditions that feed its own power, and to also minimize and suppress, and in some cases outright destroy, the precipitation of developing feedback loops of negative karma, which would jeopardize its control. Thus, with a swift execution of ruthless preemptive efficiency that's all too characteristic of Bronze Age assassins, only now infused with the information age's complexity of the cyberneticist's knowledge of dynamical systems and the techno-tribal mystics' everything-affects-everything metaphysics of holism, by reinforcing subservient life conditions and rewarding those who contribute to the chaos avatar's cause of maintaining environmental supremacy, chaos avatars succeed in restoring humanity to the music of the spheres by consolidating power into itself for the realization of its individual potentials by driving all those it meets toward the deepest realization of their own or into early graves. As such, truth evolves for chaos avatars so that what others perceive as the laws of Mother Nature are, for the chaos avatar, nothing more than her habits. habits which can be bent to suit its whims, provided one possesses sufficient mastery over the knowledge articulating the means to do so. Consequently, since facts for Chaos Avatars are perceived as flexible things and far from binding, the Chaos Avatar's concept of knowledge tends to favor definitions which describe themselves in terms of whatever increases the power and control it enjoys over the future of its current life conditions. Hence, it should come as no surprise that Chaos Avatars make for far less emphasis on adapting to the facts rather than discovering what could be done with them, which is why a Chaos Avatar's outlook tends to be future-paced and subject to swift, ruthless change of direction. That others' interests enter into the Chaos Avatar's consideration to the degree that one's own interests are perceived as contingent upon them should hardly be surprising given the scale and power of the Chaos Avatar's superego. So, in the Nietzschean psyche of the Chaos Avatar, cybernetic principles synthesized with Machiavellian politics in a neo-Faustian worldview where power struggles are perceived as not only natural and right, but, provided the Chaos Avatar's propensity to regard others as cybernetic self-extensions, are given to conspiring in the name of consolidating power and authority within itself through direct and indirect paths of action that are systemic, subtle, and comprehensive, and ultimately viral. And since what takes precedence before anything else in the Chaos Avatar's estimates is all that enhances the power and control over the systems that reinforce its life conditions, Chaos Avatars maintain supremacy over the virtuous and vicious cycles in their environments, which overt displays of power and were designed not merely to shock and awe, but also to seek and destroy the seeds of competing future life conditions that would develop in time to undermine the Chaos Avatar's quest for self-actualization. That's the statement in broad and the breaking news of the discovery of the Coral V-Meme.
Wonderful. Now, with that said, with this revelation in itself, okay, mm-hmm. How can we use this Coral thinking to facilitate the evolution of the next stages of human consciousness? In a nutshell, from what you had mentioned right there, we have less than 4 minutes left within the show.
Okay. Well, one of the techniques that people can really use is to learn to have faith in chaos. They need to begin to understand that life is sufficiently sophisticated in a self-organizing system that in many different instances, they need to trust the chaos of their environments to self-organize in such a way that it's going to be conducive towards the whole. Because Chaos Avatars, Coral Thinkers, understand that everything is so sufficiently complex that if you ever interject yourself and control needs to be taken, it needs to be swift, it needs to be brief, because if you maintain control for too long of a system, you're going to destroy the balance of the system, and the system is ultimately going to adapt to synthesize into you into a subordinate role that is dependent upon.
So basically what you're saying is that the cycle of a particular system has completed itself, it must evolve to the next stage?
That's a component of it. What I'm saying is that people need to understand that the chaos of their environments has a deeper intelligence in it that they can't see. And if you need to take control of that system, it should only be brief, because you don't want to disrupt that natural intelligence. And another thing is that another idea that people can use would simply be this. If you do need to take control of the system, it's incredibly important for you to realize that you need to set up another system that situates yourself, that stands between you, and the negative consequences of the system you're about to hijack. You need to set up something like a shock, like a buffer or a surge protector that's able to absorb the negative repercussions of whatever it is that you're going to be hijacking in the event that it does generate negative repercussions. Because whenever you do take control of a system which is sufficiently complex, there's blowback, and you need to be indemnified from that. And Coral Thinkers know how to do that. A third idea, is that people want to develop the ability to isolate and to identify the leverage points in their environment that are responsible for shifting the entire flow of events in their environment with minimal effort. Don't strive to change the whole system. Locate the leverage points that cause change. For example, Buckminster Fuller identified that at the end of a rudder in a ship, there's a tiny little piece of wood called a trim tab. And just by switching that trim tab down, you could cause the entire ship to turn, and it takes no effort at all. Likewise, Coral Thinkers are able to identify the leverage points in their environment, and with almost no effort at all, put a tiny flick of a switch, and the self-organizing intellect of that system is going to synergize together, and it's going to be driven into the direction of the momentum it applied at the leverage point. And last but not least, another idea that we could probably bang out would be conscious evolution, which is another concept that Coral Thinkers utilize. Now, conscious evolution simply means this. If you would like to evolve, you need to set yourself up and orchestrate a system of environmental conditions that are capable of changing you. You don't just change blindly. You don't just try to change you without changing the system. Change your system first completely. Change the scenery you're living. Reorganize your diet. Reorganize the entire system that you're in into such a way that it would support the person who you would be, if you were the person you needed to become already. And what would happen is that through that conscious process of evolution, the system will begin to psychosocially condition you to develop into the being that you're aspiring to become. That's another concept of a coral vemium that we've discovered. And last but not least, what we could bang out is a concept which I call dark synergy. Because deception comes into play when we're dealing with coral thinkers. And if you're going to be a coral thinker, you're going to need to know how to outfox and how to outsmart other coral thinkers by organizing your own conspiracies to counteract their disinformation. So if you need to basically cloak whatever it is that you're, whatever information that you're putting out, then you just, it's not enough to lie about something because people will discover that lie. Rather, you're going to have to come up with a rationalization for why it is that you're doing that already is present as an effect that we could observe in the plan itself. So you need to identify a consequence of the course of action that is in common with the agenda that you're trying to realize. And rather than tell people what your goal is directly, you tell people what the goal is. You tell people that a consequence of that goal that is not directly associated with your agenda is the goal. And as a result, if people are striving to obstruct your ability to achieve your goals, they start attacking the wrong point of focus. So you defer them over here. They're attacking the entire wrong symptom, but it's so consistent with the plan that they can't distinguish it as not really being part of the plan, as not being true. So you say one thing that is actually a genuine true-to-life consequence of you achieving your goals, and you say the production of that effect is the reason you're doing it, and if other people object to that, they'll attack that point, but they're really treating only a symptom and not the root cause. They're not obstructing you from attaining your goal. These are some coral thinking memes that we've discovered through our interview process that empowers people with the ability to make transitions towards coral thinking. If other people would like to discover more coral memes, they can visit www.avatarparadigms.com and solicit the request, and I'd be more than obliged to go ahead and share this information with them.
Now, Mr. Carano, Mike, with less than, say, about 30 seconds left within the second segment or the last segment of the broadcast, any inspiring words for our audience members as a capstone for all of this wisdom of this type of systems theory?
Yes. In every situation that you'll ever be in your life, you're always going to be faced with four fundamental choices: control, adapt, migrate, or die.
So, my audience members, if you would love to reach Mr. M.A. Carano, experimental philosopher and systems consultant, for any assistance as it pertains to problem solving and in life per se, expert opinions, public appearances, speaking events, life coaching, business counseling, personal training, or even existential consulting services, or even simply to field your questions or concerns regarding matters of personal, professional, political, or philosophical importance, then feel at liberty to visit his website again at www.avatarparadigms.com. Again, that is www.avatarparadigms.com, and you can submit your inquiry today. And so thank you, dear friend, Mr. Carano.
Thank you.
And we will most definitely stay in touch for sure, and bless you in all that you do, dear brother.
Thank you, Joel. It was a pleasure. Power to you. We'll be right back.
miss this show or any other previous broadcasts, please visit us at Quantum Mindfulness Radio's official website at www.quantummindfulnessradio.com. Again, that is www.quantummindfulnessradio.com. All previous and prior broadcasts are archived on the BBS Radio Network. Please join us every other Monday, 8 p.m. Pacific, 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, only on the BBS Radio Network. Again, I thank you once more for joining us here tonight on Quantum Mindfulness Radio.